Do turn in your Bibles to chapter 12 of the book of Acts, and we ask, who's in charge? That's the question the video asked us earlier. Who's in control? King of the castle. Who plays that role? Politics can make us ask that question, but so can life generally. So can suffering. They can make us wonder, well, who is in charge? So can sharing the gospel. Sometimes it doesn't seem to get very far or very fast. And we tell people about Jesus and we invite them to Christianity Explored and we're met with muted responses. This Bible passage in Acts chapter 12 is first and foremost about the fact that God is in charge. God is in control. King of the castle, he plays that role. And as we look at this passage together this morning, we're going to see four consequences to the fact that God is in charge. God is in charge, and so these four things are true. Number one, God is in charge, and so Herod can plot. Herod can plot. Herod can plot all he likes, but he's not going to get very far. In verse 1, King Herod is introduced, and Herod is a name, of course, we've heard before, because the Herod family is a bit of a dynasty in New Testament times. There's loads of them. They get everywhere. And they were in charge of different parts of Israel for the better part of 50 years. So here's the Herod family tree. It's complicated. You've got Herod the Great at the top. He's the one who ordered the slaughter of all the baby boys born in Bethlehem. And then in the next generation, he's got four sons, and the third one is Herod Antipas. He's the third son of Herod the Great. He's the one who had John the Baptist killed. He's the one who was there at the trials of Jesus, conducting one of those trials, laughing at him. But it's in the next generation that we've got today's Herod. This is Herod Agrippa the First. So what happened is Herod the Great's first son, Aristobulus, had two children who are mentioned in the Bible. He had a daughter, Herodias, and she was in a relationship with two of his brothers. So that's two of her uncles at different times. I think that tells you a little bit about the family. But then Aristobulus also had a son, Herod Agrippa the First. So this is Herod the Great's grandson. Now that's a complicated family tree. And you could go down a generation further, and I didn't even know some of these people were related to the Herods, but we'll get to them later in Acts. But it's important because it's telling us that when Herod Agrippa arrests James and Peter in this passage, he's part of a bigger picture. Every Herod in his family has opposed Jesus in one way or another. So this isn't just about personal opposition to the gospel. He's representing effectively all rulers who tried to stand against the gospel in different ages and in different eras. And in verse 1, about that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. That's a deliberately vague time reference from Luke, because this actually happened before chapter 11. He's arranged it this way to fit with his theme. But then in verse 2, we hear Herod has killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. This is not the same James who's mentioned later in the chapter. That's Jesus' brother, James. But James the apostle is executed. He's the first of the apostles to die. And this was prophesied, his death was prophesied by Jesus in Mark 10, 39. And unlike when Judas died, I suppose Judas was the first to die, wasn't he? But James isn't replaced as an apostle because James is still an apostle. Judas lost his claim to be an apostle. James, he's more alive than he's ever been. He's in the presence of Christ. He is one of the 12 for all time. But then verse 3, when Herod saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. This was during the days of unleavened bread. This is Passover time. It's the same time of year that Jesus was arrested. And so just as you've got Jesus, arrested at Passover, delivered over to Herod, and then brought out to be killed in order to satisfy a baying crowd, Peter now finds himself in the same situation. Verse 4, then when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him over to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out to the people. So four squads of soldiers, that's four groups, probably of four, who took their turn on shifts. And at any one time, you've got two soldiers chained to Peter, and another one outside the door, and another one outside the further door. We're going to see that in verses 6 and 10. And you would think, well, isn't that overkill for one fisherman turned apostle? But perhaps Herod has heard what happened last time Peter was in prison. Acts chapter 5, verse 19. During the night, an angel of the Lord opened the prison doors and brought them out. So Herod isn't taking any chances. Well, what happens next? The guards keeping Peter in prison are about as effective as the soldiers guarding the tomb on Resurrection Sunday. Peter escapes, and we'll come back to that. But jump down to Herod's reaction in verse 18 while we're on Herod. When day came, there was no little disturbance among the soldiers about what had become of Peter. And after Herod searched for him and did not find him, he examined the sentries and ordered that they should be put to death. And that's normal practice in that era. That was the way the Romans operated. The job of a prison guard was to guard prisoners. And if they escaped, the prison guard would get the sentence that the prisoners would have received. And clearly claiming that an angel did it, or we don't know, didn't satisfy Herod. But take a step back. What's going on in this passage? Herod's plotting, isn't he? He doesn't see it, I don't think. I don't think he particularly sees it as setting out to cause difficulty for Christians. That's not his primary goal. I think his primary goal is to make his political life easier. He's trying to keep the Romans happy. They've given him this role. He's trying to keep the Jews happy. He's ruling over them. They automatically don't like him because the Romans put him in this role. And the Christians, well, they just happen to be the collateral damage. They're an easy target. Everyone's happy. So it's not his primary target, but nonetheless, he is plotting against Christians, and by doing that, he is pitting himself against God, which is not wise. When Jesus meets Saul on the road to Damascus, he says, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" Herod doesn't realize, perhaps, that to persecute the church is to persecute Jesus. And when you think about the power that Herod has, that the weapons and the tactics he's got at his disposal, they're quite significant, aren't they? He can have Christians killed for no real reason, and as far as he can see, with no real consequences. He's got the might of the state behind him. He commands the soldiers. He owns the prisons. But when you compare that to the power of God, it's nothing. As Jesus said to Pilate, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above." God made the soldiers. God made the earth from which the prison was built. God made Herod. God appointed Herod to rule over Judea. Daniel says in the Old Testament, God changes times and seasons. God removes kings and sets up kings. God's in charge. So what's God's reaction to Herod's plotting? Well, the Psalms tell us that. In Psalm 2, it says, "Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed." That's what's going on here. So what does God do? How does he respond when the kings and the peoples plot? Psalm 2, "He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. And then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury. So God's response to Herod's plots to kill Peter is laughter. That's because the idea of even the most powerful human kings being able to successfully oppose God and thwart God's plan, it's laughable to him. Just ask Pharaoh. God's in charge, so Herod can plot, but it won't work. Just like with a plot against Jesus. In fact, it says back in Acts chapter 4, truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel. So they gathered together to do what? To do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. They were all gathered, Acts 4, to do whatever God's hand and God's plan had predestined to take place. And so when Jesus died on the cross, all these unlikely allies, they joined together to get rid of him once and for all. And it was all part of God's plan, who then raised Jesus from the dead. It's part of his plan to rescue us. So Jesus would die and then rise again so that we could have our sins forgiven and be friends with God. That's the Christian message that we're called to respond to. But now, these 10, 11 years later, Herod Agrippa, the nephew of the Herod who was involved in Jesus' death, Herod Agrippa, again, he can plot all he likes. God's in charge. Now, I don't know what the future holds for the gospel in this country. I don't think our government is particularly anti-Christian. I think that the laws that end up restricting street preaching or evangelism or Christian adoptive parents or Christian schools, these laws are often not targeted at Christians, but we end up as collateral damage, as the easy targets. Now, you might agree or disagree with that analysis, but this passage in Acts reminds us we've got the same God as the God of Acts 12. Sometimes he will work in dramatic ways, often less dramatic. But this passage in Acts reminds us that however much kings or governments or rulers or MPs or borough councillors or anyone else desires to restrict the spread of the gospel, they can do nothing except what God's hand and God's plan has predestined to take place. And that's a big encouragement. Point number two, that the second consequence of the fact that God is in charge is that Peter can sleep. Peter can sleep. Given how little it takes to stop me sleeping, I'm amazed by verse 6. When Herod was about to bring him out, on that very night, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries before the door were guarding the prison. How can he sleep? Yes, he's been in prison before. Yes, he's been rescued by God before, but one of his closest friends was killed days earlier. And Herod plans to kill him too. How can he sleep? He can sleep because he knows that God's in charge. If you were here a couple of months ago, perhaps you heard our sermon on sleep. And in that message, we saw that the biggest reason the Bible gives to help us sleep is trusting that God watches over us while we sleep. The biggest reason the Bible gives to help us sleep is trusting that God watches over us while we sleep. Psalm 121, behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. God doesn't sleep, so we can. He watches over us while we sleep. But it goes further than that, because often what stops us from sleeping, what causes us worry and anxiety, it's not the fear of what will happen to us while we're asleep, it's the fear of what will happen to us tomorrow when we wake up. That's what keeps us lying awake at night. Yet Peter, who has genuine reason to be concerned about what will happen in the morning, is fast asleep in his prison cell. So much so, he's having nice dreams about being set free. Peter can sleep not only because God watches over him while he sleeps, but also because God's in charge of what will happen in the morning. His sleep is a picture of his trust that God's in charge. Knowing that God is in charge can give us peace about anything and everything that
Peter knows if he dies, it's because God has set that moment as the time to bring him home to heaven. And if he lives, it's because God has not set that moment as the time to bring him home to heaven. God still has something for him to do. As the Apostle Paul wrote to the Philippians, when he also was sitting in a prison cell, for me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. And as Dave said to me when I spoke to him in hospital this week, he said it's a win-win situation. We are safe and secure until our work on earth for the gospel is done. And for Peter, it's not yet done. In verse 7, the prison break begins. Behold, an angel of the Lord stood next to him, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him, saying, "Get up quickly." And the chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, "Dress yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. And he said to him, "Wrap your cloak round you and follow me." And there's something really special hidden in those verses. Cast your mind back to the days after Jesus' resurrection. In John chapter 21, Peter and Jesus have a conversation. Jesus says something a little bit cryptic, but we're told that he's predicting Peter's death. And Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you're old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." And it's explained to us that's predicting Peter's death, the time he's going to be crucified, which eventually happens in the 60s AD. That's 20 years after this prison break. But it's that little detail. You'll stretch out your hands, another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. But what does the angel say to Peter in the prison cell? "Dress yourself, put on your sandals, wrap your cloak around you and follow me." I love that, because by referencing Jesus' words to Peter, Peter surely would have been remembering them, given that tomorrow might be the day he dies. But God's saying to Peter through the angel, "It's not time yet. I decide when the time is, because I'm in charge, not Herod and not these soldiers. So let's get you out of here." Chains fall off, verse 7. The guards are somehow oblivious to what's going on, blinded, asleep, who knows. The gate opens for them of its own accord in verse 10, before the days of automatic doors, and the angel leads Peter onto one of the city streets, and only then does he realize it's really happening. He comes to himself in verse 11, "Now I'm sure the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me." He goes to Mary's house, verse 12. That's not Mary, Jesus' mother, and that's also not Mary Magdalene. It's a different Mary, and she's the mother of John Mark, who we'll be hearing about in the next few weeks. But we see that God's in charge of the big picture and in the small details. Sometimes the kids sing that song, "He's the God of the big, he's the God of the little, he's the God of the stuff," somewhere in the middle. So in the big picture, yes, it's easy for us to look around and get downcast or downhearted. I know Christians who can get pessimistic and a bit, "Woe is me, woe is us," at the state of our nation. And yet, yes, we can grieve about sin, but God's in charge. He's not less powerful now than he was then. Again, we say, however much kings or governments or rulers or MPs or anyone else desires to restrict the spread of the gospel, they can do nothing except what God's hand and God's plan has predestined to take place. But also right down to the little things, the things that go through your head late at night that keep you awake with worry. What's going to happen to me or my loved ones? What about this illness? What about my job? What about this problem at work? What about my finances? What about something I've done that might come into the light? What about anything and everything? For me last night, what about Christianity Explored? How's that going to go? And this passage reminded me last night, and it reminds us this morning, to trust the God who holds you with his everlasting arms. He's in charge. Peter could sleep in prison because he trusted God. And later in Acts, Paul will sing in prison because he trusts God. And it doesn't mean nothing bad will ever happen. You've got James in verse 2. It does mean
that nothing can happen that the loving and good God does not permit. So even the worst, even James dying, that is part of God's good, fatherly, loving plan for our lives. God's in charge, so Peter can sleep, we can trust. Point number three, the church can pray. God's in charge, so the church can pray. And here we come to what the church has been up to while Peter has been all chained up. And verse 5 is where we're first told, no big surprise, Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. And then down in verse 12, he goes to the house of Mary and Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. And we get a great snapshot of the praying church here in this short section. We find out what their prayer life was like. We see that there's together prayer. Together prayer. The body, the church, coming together to pray. Sometimes it's called corporate prayer. It's not everyone in their own houses shooting up their own arrow prayers. Not that that's bad, but it's the church joining together to pray. Now, prayer isn't a numbers game, is it? It's not about getting enough people to pray enough prayers for enough hours with enough fervency that you get what you want. Sometimes God will work through the simple cry of one individual. Sometimes he will seem not to answer despite the prayers of thousands. So it's not a numbers game, but there is something undeniably powerful about the gathered church coming together to pray. Whether it's on a Wednesday night or a Sunday night or on any other day or night, whether it's regular or spontaneous, the church prayer meeting should be the most exciting meeting of the week. You hear far more in Acts about prayer meetings than about Sunday worship services. Far more happens in them. Not that we're being asked to choose, but we see they pray together. And verse 5 tells us they pray earnestly. Don't really use the word earnest a lot, do we? It's trying to convey this wholehearted, sincere persistence in prayer, but we actually get a good picture of earnest prayer from something else in the New Testament. Luke, the same author who wrote this bit, Luke wrote in chapter 22 of his other book about Jesus. He withdrew from them about a stone's throw. He knelt down. He prayed, saying, "Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." And there appeared to him an angel from heaven strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. And his sweat became like great drops of blood falling to the ground. And I think that's incredible to use the same adverb to describe the church praying as was used to describe Jesus praying. Jesus prayed so earnestly, he began to sweat like blood. The church prays earnestly for Peter. So do we pray earnestly for God to work in this village, in this town, among our friends, within ourselves? I pray, but I don't feel like my prayer could often be described as earnest prayer. Not often enough. May God help us to pray earnestly. So, together prayer, earnest prayer. It's also imperfect prayer as well, and that's encouraging, because if we had to be as good at praying as Jesus, then nothing would ever get done. But here we see they don't believe it when Rhoda brings them the news that their prayers have been answered. Verse 15, you're out of your mind. But she kept insisting that it was so, and they kept saying, "It is his angel." And again, we have hints of similarities to Jesus' arrest. Now there's echoes of his resurrection. Who is the witness who first sees Peter delivered from death? The least respected person in the household. Rhoda, the servant girl. What's the reaction when she tells them, "I've seen Peter"? Disbelief. Just as it was written in Luke 20.
course he's in control, but he's got his plan and he probably won't. It's easy to get cynical about prayer. It's easy, almost as a defensive mechanism. It stops you being too disappointed if your prayers don't get answered the way you hope. And this passage delivers a gentle rebuke to that way of thinking. God answers their prayers despite their wavering faith. He is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think, and he does. Sometimes you hear people argue that because God's sovereign and God's in charge, that's a reason not to pray. He's got it all worked out anyway. But that's not how the Bible approaches this question. Here, we can pray because God is sovereign. We're talking to the one who has the power to do something. It doesn't mean we'll always get the outcome we expect or hope for. I'm sure they had a prayer meeting the night James died as well. Why does one live and one die? Well, we don't know. This passage calls us to hold two things together. Because God's in control, on the one hand, we should expect God to answer our prayers in dramatic and wonderful ways. Yet at the same time, like Jesus, we should be able to say, not my will, but yours be done. We need to live with that mystery of God's providence and sovereign care. So send Evangelical. Let's keep praying. I was encouraged on Wednesday night. We had the women's meeting at church, and three of us met in my lounge to pray for the women. Just three, but we felt a great blessing of God as we prayed. And we prayed for what was happening at church, and we prayed for all sorts of things for the women in our church, for your godliness and for your witness and for your relationships and for your work and in all things to be more like Christ. And I was so encouraged to think that as we prayed, the topic was very different from the prayer meeting in Acts 12, but the power was the same. As we prayed, I have no doubt that God was using those prayers to great effect among you. And just as I have no doubt that if you gather at Val's this Wednesday to pray for the men, I have no doubt it will be the same in reverse. And so whether we're praying for one another, or for the preaching on Sundays, or for Christianity Explored, for North or South Korea, or for our own nation that seems to be drifting away from God, or for gospel conversations, or for deliverance from temptation, or for strength in the midst of trials, or whatever else, let's keep praying. One preacher said, we can pray as if no one were listening, as if nothing might happen, and as if nothing were at stake. May that not be true of us. And fourthly and finally this morning, God is in charge, so the word will advance. God is in charge, so the word not can, but will advance. Verses 20 to 24, they feel a little bit disjointed from the rest of the story, don't they? But they are really closely linked. It's Herod coming to meet his end. We've got this situation where the people of Tyre and Sidon have angered Herod somehow, and that's a problem for them because they're dependent on him for food. So they need to get back in his good books, and so they arrange a meeting with him, and they decide to flatter him. And then verse 21 tells us what happens on an appointed day. Herod put on his royal robes, and he took his seat upon the throne and delivered an oration to them, and the people were shouting, the voice of a god and not of a man. It's a little bit different to what they were shouting at our prime minister, wasn't it, on Friday morning? We find, actually, this is one of the times when the Bible account is verified by the history books. We don't need the Bible to be verified, to trust it. It's self-authenticating. It stands on its own two feet. But when you do read about ancient historical records, and they always end up confirming the Bible, it does reaffirm your faith. And for this passage, there's a Jewish historian called Josephus. He's not a Christian. You can think of him as an independent, impartial source. But Josephus tells us about how Herod was dressed in a silver robe that was reflecting the light of the sun as it rose in the morning, and the people of Tyre and Sidon cried out, until now we have reverenced you as a human being, but henceforth we confess you to be of more than mortal nature. Or, as Luke summarizes, the voice of a god, not a man. Josephus writes, "Upon this, the king did not rebuke them, nor reject their impious flattery." And compare what happens when Peter is worshipped inappropriately in Acts 10. Cornelius meets him, falls down at his feet. Peter says, "Stand up. I too am just a man." Same with Paul in chapter 14. But Herod, he doesn't do anything like that. He receives the glory, he enjoys the glory, and God judges him. In verse 23, immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give the glory, and he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. That historian Josephus says the same. Herod was suddenly seized in that moment.